On here, we are dealing with Roman numeral E on page, or pardon me, letter E on page 5 under Roman numeral 5, with issues related to inappropriate forms of shame, which the normal believer should reject and recognize is exactly that, inappropriate. E, as believers, we are to exercise sound judgment and not fall into the trap of guilt or shame that we take on ourselves for inappropriate reasons. One, self-imposed shame may come upon a person that has decided that he should have done something but didn't, or did something that may have caused hurt to someone else. Now, when we're talking here about that you don't really know, you're just guessing, you think. We're not talking about you recognize I did something wrong, it caused somebody else a problem. That is requires confession, you know, and all of that. That's pretty obvious, and as we have always suggested, that your confession of wrong should be just as wide as the wrong that was done. So if you, you know, offend five people, you apologize to all five of them. We're talking here about things where people just think they might have done it. And this gets into two here, as we'll see. Thus, self-imposed guilt means that a person has a measure of mind reading going on, a mental attitude judgment that an action, thought, or even word caused harm to another. Three, further, we are not to feel guilt or shame because we cannot meet all the needs in the world. God has not ordained us to bear every burden, Galatians 6:5. And so you have to recognize that in terms of guilt and shame, there's, again, that which is appropriate, and then that which we, out of sometimes our own faulty standards, sort of push on ourselves and then feel bad because we didn't measure up. Well, that doesn't accomplish anything. And so we have to recognize, for instance, like in terms of financial things, there's only so much you can do. And it's not required, as we pointed out here in Galatians anyway, that we all have certain responsibilities. Like in verse 2, bear one another's burdens and thus fulfill the law of Christ. A part of the law of love is to help other believers when they need help. But then verse 4, but let each one examine his own work, and he will have room in regard to boasting in regard to himself alone and not in regard to another, for each one shall bear his own load. And so you have, again, the fact that in a local church, every believer has a certain amount of responsibility for the function of that local church in terms of the physical aspects of what has to be done. And so each one has a legitimate load to carry. Then there are those issues and greater things where people get into bigger problems and they can't handle it themselves. We're not talking about the everyday normal things that we all ought to do. We're talking about when somebody has something beyond what they logically can meet. Well, A, Jesus Christ taught that the poor would be with us always, which logically indicates that we cannot eliminate every need. So Matthew 26:11. So why don't we just all stop right now and pray that God will feed everybody? Just eliminate all poverty and hunger and need and all that. Well, that's clearly not his plan. And this is where it requires some doctrinal sophistication to recognize that, number one, you can't do everything. And there is a legitimate end to it. And see, but a lot of people get under this self-imposed guilt and shame because they say no. And some people still don't know how to use the word. It's not hard. I mean, it's just two little letters. No. And sometimes that's all you have to say is no. And you got a right to say no. See, this is where people get under guilt and shame because they think, well, I don't ever have a right to say no. Sure you do. You have a right to say no. I mean, you've got to factor in all the doctrinal issues and all of that and what the issue is itself in the first place. But, yeah, you can say no. Can you do thus and such? No. And guess what? You can say no without feeling guilty. That's the beauty of doctrine. You don't have to feel guilty. You can't meet all the needs of the world. Matthew 26:11, for the poor you have with you always. Or at least until so-and-so gets on the planet. Well, no, you're going to always have poor. There's always going to be poor people, but you do not always have me. So be it as wrong to feel guilty because you have more than others or because they are suffering. Do not be tempted to play God since you don't know what people need to advance spiritually. And this gets into a real fundamental issue, is that some people would not do well spiritually with a certain measure of physical prosperity. that it would hurt them physically, that they need to be under the gun and under the test. And, of course, a part of this is the humility test, that God becomes a rewarder of those who diligently seek him. It doesn't mean he rewards them right away. Well, I've been in Bible class 3 months. Where is it? Well, it doesn't work that way. And so you have to recognize that God rewards those as he chooses to. And for some people, physical prosperity would kill them. It'd take them out of Bible class. It would not help them at all. They need the physical constraints of paying their bills and all of that. And you go through periods, and it doesn't kill people. Now, this is where we get into this sort of wrong type of guilt and shame. It doesn't hurt people to miss a meal. You know, we act like if a person doesn't have food, and we all think living grace is a part of food. I don't think any of us here think we want to see people starving. But if a person has to miss a meal, it's not the end of the world. But we've been taught to think like it is. And it's not the end of the world. Or if people don't have the money to do this or that or the other thing, it's not the end of the world. I lived a lot of my Christian life with people that had far more financially than I ever had. And still have more than I ever have. Have more than I have today. You know what? That doesn't bother me. I don't feel like, number one, oh, I'm a second-class believer because they got more. I don't look at it that way. Nor do I resent the fact that they have more. Nor do I resent them because I don't have as much as they do. It doesn't make any difference. You just have to learn to be content in the niche that God provides you. And that is a great deal more wealth than most people will ever have. If people could just learn to be content, okay, I've got it. I've got enough. And that's a part of the Christian life, is learning contentment. And that's what Paul said. I have learned to be content in whatever situation I find myself. And you're not born knowing that, trust me. Contentment's not something we're born knowing. You have to learn contentment. All right, this is the hand God has dealt me. And this is where God wants me, you know, geographic will, physical will, you know, what does God want me to think, say, and do? Directed will of God. Here's where he's got me. See, I pray about it all the time. I pray, you know, that I will be in God's directive will, that he will providentially lead me, even when I'm stupid, and keep an eye on me, and, you know, make sure I don't do anything really, really stupid. I mean, I know me. I'm capable of it, trust me. And you can do some really stupid stuff, and I pray about, you know, being where God wants me to be and all of that, but the second I get caught in a traffic, I lose my cool. Well, God's providential will is fine until I get stuck behind an idiot in traffic, and then it's no longer good. And I recognize the fallacy of my own stupidity, is what I'm pointing out here. That you can pray about God's leading and guidance, and then you find yourself in a situation where you're chafing against the bit. Well, guess what? That's part of God's providential will for your life. He wants you there. And so I recognize, you know, I pray about this, and then I recognize how I bitch about my niche because it's not going the way I want it to go. I want you to lead me, Lord, but only where I want to go. Now, are we clear? And God's like, well, yeah, I guess. But he's still going to do it his way. And so you find yourself in a situation or in a position and you think, I don't want to be here. Well, is it God's will for you to be there? Are you supposed to orient to this and stay in fellowship and move on? Or are you just going to make everyone around you miserable because you don't want to be there? Now, that you can do too. So you pray about it. And again, you don't know what people need spiritually. Some people do not do well with prosperity. They can't handle it. And, you know, I always heard there was always this one person I know that they always prayed for God to smite him with incurable wealth. Well, probably the reason he hasn't smitten them is they couldn't handle it. And some people can't handle money. That's just a sad reality. Or other physical forms of prosperity. Because then they start doing inappropriate things. And for them, there's the principle of the short leash. And the reality is, over the years, I've observed it, I do better on a short leash. And I dare say, if you checked your Christian life out too, you might find the same things true, that you do better on a short leash. One of the things I observed when I was a kid, my dad always had hunting dogs, and of course I always had to take care of them. That's the beauty of being the firstborn. And so one of the things I noticed was that the longer the leash the dog was on, the more likely he was to get tangled up, you know, or to go running off and then, you know, the choke collar would hit him and, you know, you'd see him go up and flap his back, you know, as the collar ran out. But the shorter the leash the dog was on, the less trouble he seemed to have. And so the same thing works in the Christian life and in the spiritual realm. And sometimes God keeps people on a short leash. And a short leash doesn't hurt you. But you know what we all think when God shortens up the leash, don't we? Mad dog. We're going to let God know we don't like it. Well, you may go through periods in your Christian life. You may go through periods of incredible wealth and prosperity, and you got more money than you need. And you may go through periods where you are just, it's all you can do to find two nickels to rub together. And guess what? Neither one is bad or good. It's just on how you orient to it. So again, don't assume if you've got a lot, God expects you to take care of everybody. He doesn't. Never was his. God's got a lot, and he doesn't even take care of everybody. He's got way more than we have. And he still allows people to have needs. And sometimes those needs are designed to drive them to him. And one of the things I've noticed, and you probably could validate this as well, is that in the Christian life, when do you do your most praying? When everything's going good or when you're under a lot of pressure? Probably when you're under a lot of pressure. That's when you probably pray the most. Or you've got some big test you're facing. Isn't it amazing when you're facing a big test how much you suddenly want to pray? And you don't have any problem praying. Dear God, I might be facing the death test. You can suddenly start praying. You get very prolific with your prayers right then. And so, or whatever test you might be facing. I picked the big one, the death test. But the point is, a lot of these things are designed to push us toward God. And it's not up to believers, even misguided, well-intentioned believers, to step in and alleviate all of that. Sometimes you're just actually getting in God's way. And you may get some discipline for that. God may keep telling you, get out of the way. Let me handle this. But that gets into the concept of faith rest, and we have to recognize that we don't know everything, and that God can handle not only me, but every other believer in this church. And you have to have some faith in that, and that God's going to take care of people. But all what we're here for is to maximize your positive volition in terms of maturity and completing your course. We're not here to get you rich. That never was the intention. Or to give you a bunch of prosperity. If God blesses you with that, fine, so be it. I don't have any problem with it. In fact, I pray for my congregation's prosperity. And John prayed for his, and that's the prayer I offer up, that you'll prosper and be in good health even as your soul prospers. I like to tie it back to doctrine like John did. If God's going to bless you, it needs to be doctrinally. And so, you know, because people can go out, we know, and pursue blessing and get stuff and may not be God. I got a credit card with $10,000 on it. What does God want me to have today? Well, maybe nothing. But that's not necessarily so easy. You know, get your Home Depot credit card and, you know, there you go. We were up there yesterday, so. What would I like? Now, if you, you know, especially like, you know, if you're a new homeowner, which we've all been, you know, some of us more recently than others, but if you're a new homeowner, you're thinking, the sky's, you can go into Home Depot and it's like church. You know, and those little orange aprons are your God, you know. So, but, you know, again, just because God, you know, you've got the potential to have some. I mean, I've got credit card. I could go rack up 30 grand today in debt. But that doesn't mean it's God's will for me to. In fact, I counsel most people, if you got a credit card, pay it off at the end of the month or don't charge on it. But, I mean, if you have to carry a balance, that's your business. We're not going to revoke your soul because you got a balance on your credit card. But, again, try, you know, don't use it to pursue things and don't use it to get yourself in trouble. That's, you know, we counsel that, too. Well, see, some believers simply fall into the trap of feeling guilty because they cannot endure the thought of others suffering. And you better get, you got to get over that because believers are going to suffer. I've suffered. You've suffered. It didn't kill us, did it? We've suffered lots of things, different tests all of us have faced that we've gone through and we've passed. And nobody could jump in and bail us out. Make it go away. God had to work us through it in his time. And sometimes it was quick. Sometimes it was slow. Some tests are short, some tests are longer. Some tests last for days, some last for weeks, some last for years, let's face it. So you're under a test that lasts for years. Well, you kind of just got to buckle down and say, okay, this test is going to last for years, and I got to deal with it, and then handle it under doctrine. So, you know, no one likes, I don't think, normal people, again, no one likes to see other people suffer. I don't like seeing people suffer. But the fact that they're suffering doesn't mean it's God's will for me to jump in. Maybe it's God's will for them to suffer. And this is where, as a believer, you got to be careful and not try to play God. And as a pastor, you really got to be careful. You can't play God over the life of your congregation. And that's the real, you know, because you got authority as a pastor, and you think, well, you know, I want the best for them. And sure you do. We all, I assume most normal pastors want the best for their congregation. But you can't guarantee it for them. And if they have to suffer, they have to suffer. So be it. And they may be suffering for deserved reasons. They may be suffering for undeserved reasons. That's the more of the challenging thing is to watch. When you see someone suffering, you know, well, you know, it's not their fault. And then you see people and they're suffering and you recognize they got a little culpability in this. Then you see people suffering and you recognize it's all their fault. There's various levels of culpability in terms of when you suffer. So I have to recognize, yeah, sometimes you see people in your congregation, they're suffering, they're going through hard things. Well, you pray for them, but at a certain level, that's all you can do and leave it up to God. Now, there may be a time to step in and help, and hey, if I can help you, sure. If I don't have to violate doctrine and, you know, I know that this isn't all just self-induced misery. This is just a test for you, and I can step in and alleviate some of the pressure. Sure, I don't have a problem with that at all. And so the point is, you've got to pray about it and use some discretion and discernment and, you know, all of that. And that requires thinking and prayer rather than just, I feel guilty, let's act. You don't need to act just because you feel guilty. That's inappropriate guilt dumping. Turn around and judge it for what it is. You know, that's inappropriate guilt. I shouldn't feel guilty. I'm going to reject that. And then move on. Say, well, how can you do that? Well, you've got to be able to do it. Otherwise, you're just going to be tormenting yourself needlessly for things that you don't have any control over. And one should recognize that it is unacceptable to feel shame over the failures of another, no matter how serious their failures may be. The person that failed should experience the shame, not the person that was wronged. And that's another whole point. We see people that fail, and they come under a certain amount of discipline and misery and all of that. And sure, you feel bad for them, you do. I mean, normal believers feel bad about that stuff. But guess what? It doesn't mean it's up to you to step in. Doesn't mean it's up to you to alleviate it or eliminate it. And it's certainly not up to me to feel shame because one of you goes out and fails and does something stupid. It does not reflect on me at a certain level. You have to recognize that. That's a part of growing up and with your kids as they get older. You got to recognize they do what they do, and at a certain level, it doesn't reflect on you. It's hard not to feel that way when you're a parent. I mean, because you take it all personally as a parent, of course. And as a pastor, sometimes you take it all personally. You think, well, what could I have done different? You know, I've given up on that stuff. What could I have done different? What could they have done different? They're the one that's in this mess, not me. You know, I've taught the doctrine. If people listen to it and follow it and pay attention, they'll do all right. I don't think we've counseled anybody to the wrong paths here. So, again, you have to, you know, there's no shame when other people fail to me, to you. It's their shame. And at a certain level, you got to leave it as their shame. Let them deal with it. You don't take some of it on yourself. You know, and obviously, you know, to whatever level you may be culpable in the thing, yeah, then you should bear your own, you know, guilt and all that. But beyond that, no. No, you can't feel guilty about what other people have done. That's not your sin. That's theirs. Gee, in that regard, the Word of God clearly teaches that there are those that do not have the normal, healthy, spiritually emotions of shame and conduct themselves in a horrible fashion. One, negative unbelievers who attempt to infiltrate the church and destroy the morals and faith of believers are viewed as being continually restless, and their shameful lifestyle is viewed as the filthy scum that is deposited on the seashore. Jude 13, if you've ever been out to, of course, we're on the Gulf side, so you don't get it as much, but if you ever go out to the beach after a storm and all this, you'll see all this foam and junk wash up on the shore, the scum that comes off and various debris and all that. Well, that's how Jude views these people. Jude 13, as he says here, he uses the worst terms to describe these false teachers, and this is primarily an indictment. It's a prophecy, but it's an indictment of liberal unbelievers that have infiltrated the church in the last days. They existed in a small way in Jude's day, and that's why he writes. This wasn't his intention even to write about this. In fact, he tells them that at the beginning of the letter. I was going to write you about our common faith and blah, 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 but I felt very impressed that I need to write this. And so under the leading of the Holy Spirit, he writes this indictment, this prophecy with respect to the last days. Again, existed in his day in a small way, but many of these things, the small form, the germ form in which they existed in the early church, has become full-blown apostasy now and has taken on a whole life of its own. So these are people here, negative unbelievers who attempt to infiltrate the church. Wild ways, he calls them, of the sea, casting up their own shame like foam. Wandering stars for whom the black darkness has been reserved forever. And he deals about the fact, and those, and about these also Enoch. And this is in the apocryphal book of Enoch. And so while we wouldn't study it, we would have to say that this quote that is cited here out of Enoch is inspired. Because it's in the Bible, not because Enoch said it per se. And actually, Enoch didn't write this book. They just put Enoch's name on it. Enoch in the seventh from Adam prophesied, saying, "Behold, the Lord came with many thousands of his holy ones to execute judgment on all and to convict all the ungodly of all their ungodly deeds which they have done in an ungodly way and in all the harsh things which ungodly sinners have spoken against him." You think he's trying to highlight their ungodliness in that verse a little bit? Yeah. Well, two negative believers that have left the straight and narrow are often proud of the very things of which they should legitimately be ashamed. Philippians 3:19, here now in this context, dealing with believers, not unbelievers. In the other one, it was negative unbelievers infiltrating the church. Here it's believers that have departed the straight and narrow, who've left doctrine to pursue whatever. And if you talk to them, they'll tell you how proud they are of themselves, how right they are, and all that. Well, guess what? They're not. Starts in verse 18, "Many walk, of whom I often told you and now tell you even weeping, they are enemies of the cross of Christ, whose end is destruction, whose God is their appetite." Actually, the word there is belly, and it really means their emotions. They're emotional wrecks. And you look at some of these people who aren't on doctrine, and they are simply emotional wrecks, who've departed doctrine. And they run on their emotions, and how they feel determines everything. And whose glory is in their shame, who set their minds on earthly things. And that's a lot of people, again, who wandered off from the straight and narrow. Three of the Jews of Jeremiah's day had hardened their hearts to the point where they did not have the normal shame that should characterize God's people. Jeremiah 6:15. Were they ashamed? And here dealing actually primarily first here with the communicator, the prophets and the priests. They all deal falsely, verse 13, "And they have superficially healed the brokenness of my people, saying, peace, peace, but there is no peace." See, that's human viewpoint, and that's just wrong. When somebody's really under judgment and God's disciplining them and laying it on them, don't walk in and tell them, "Oh, it's okay, God's for you." Well, he may be for them, but that's probably not what they need to hear right then. They probably just need to work through what God's doing in their life. And it isn't always pleasant. Were they ashamed because of the abomination they have done? They were not even ashamed at all. They do not even know how to blush. "Therefore, they will fall among those who fall. At the time that I punish them, they will be cast down, says the Lord." Roman numeral 6 here now, human viewpoint methods employed when attempting to deal with shame that are nothing more than reactions that fail to accept the grace of God. Now, that's what we have to deal with now. You're going to have two types of shame, the legit and the non-legit. Now, you're going to have to deal with them, and you need to deal with them in a biblical fashion and not just according to human viewpoint or how you feel and all of that. Legitimate shame, you're going to have to deal with it. And non-legitimate shame, you're going to have to learn how to reject it and deal with it through doctrine, rather than walking around with all this guilt and shame that's just actually self-imposed. That's got to be the worst form of self-imposed misery, to walk around feeling guilty and shameful when in fact you're not. That makes you maladjusted. A, shame is an unrelenting feeling of not being worthy or of being unworthy of being wanted or loved. This can occur whenever you believe the lie that you're worthless. Now, you may do some really dumb stuff. You may feel worthless from time to time. Doesn't mean you are worthless. That's the whole point. What we're getting at here is you have to learn to deal with and acknowledge the fact that, yeah, there's a huge difference between feeling worthless and being worthless. And sometimes our feelings of worthlessness come out of other issues. Don't have anything to do, really, with the fact that we're worthless. And if we were worthless, I would assume God would take us out. That's my fundamental contention. If a person's really that worthless, why would God allow them, you know, why wouldn't he just take them out? And obviously there's a bunch of reasons. We do recognize that too. Sometimes God leads people to mislead other people, to pull out their negative volitions, like with Antichrist. Clearly God's not going to kill Antichrist, but he's really a worthless human being in every sense of the word. And God's going to allow him to live. So the point is, but in terms of the local church, I think God's got, you know, obviously a bigger stake in this, we might say, with us. We are his people, whereas Antichrist obviously is not. And so God lets people go off and do their thing, and he doesn't kill them the minute they go negative or do something stupid. If he did that, again, they'd be stacked up like cordwood outside the door. You know? And if all the people that have gone negative were back on doctrine, you couldn't hold them in the churches. We'd all have to have huge buildings. So, again, don't believe the lie that you're worthless, even if you feel that way. B, at this point, we become threatened with being exposed and feel in danger of being humiliated and rejected by others, which we may think we deserve. And sometimes, again, a lot of this goes on. You've got to ask yourself, a lot of times when something's happening, stop and ask yourself, when you're in the middle of a big pressure and it's really bothering you, is this happening anywhere besides my own mind? Where is this happening? Is this going on anywhere else except right here? And if it's going on right there, then ask yourself the question, well, wait a minute. If this isn't really happening outside my mind, is it real? See, one of the amazing things is if you do LSD, you're going to think a lot of things, trust me. But they won't be going on anywhere outside except of your own mind. They're not going on outside. They're going on in here. Well, people trip all the time, frankly. Frankly, a lot of people are spiritually tripping, you know. And the things that are going on just go on up here. They're not really going on in reality. They're just going on here, and then they start to believe it. That's the danger when you start to believe your own BS. That's a real danger in the Christian life. Three, since excessive shame is a prison, it can keep a person feeling trapped in feelings of worthlessness, self-hatred, and even depression and despair. D, therefore, many resort to inappropriate techniques to deal with shame, since it is something that one may seek to avoid at all costs. Well, E, the excessively responsible or controlling response. One, because the person feels shame about various things that have or may happen. He seeks to make life right by overworking, constantly giving to others in an attempt to make everyone happy. Guess what? It's not your job to make everyone happy. You say, well, I want people to be happy. Well, so do I. What do you think, I'm just a jackass that doesn't care? Of course I do. But you know what? I've realized it's not my job to make everyone happy. Can you imagine the burden that is walking around with that feeling all the time? It's my responsibility. I mean, at a certain level, even as a pastor in a church, I have to cut the apron strings and say, you know, these sheep got to walk on their own. I can't live the Christian life for them. They got to sort it out. I can pray for them. I can love them. I can teach them. But they got to handle it. I can't be responsible for everything they do. I mean, I'd have shot myself already if I was responsible for everything everybody ever did within the church. I mean, I'd have done given up, but I'm not. So, again, that's the danger, and you have to recognize some people have a tendency towards being control freaks. They want to be in control of everything, and you have to fight that. I recognized it a long time ago in myself. So you can't control everything. You have to sit back sometimes and say, okay, God's here. I'm not in control. I'm not in control. God's in control. You don't have to own. you know, as far as I know, the word om isn't sinful either. It's not like a curse word or anything. But the point is, you have to recognize that and get past that at some level. I mean, if you're going to try to control everything in your niche, you are going to be a miserable, overworked, uptight person. Why? Because you're trying to control everything. And sometimes you just have to learn to let go and let God. I mean, that's an old fundy saying, but it's true. At a certain level, you can't control everything. And you just have to say, you know, I've just got to, you know, hey, what they are or what they aren't, you use your authority. Now, if you have authority, obviously, you can't just always check out on that one. Say, well, I'm the authority, so I don't have to worry about it. No, you've still got responsibilities before God. But it doesn't mean your job is to control everyone under your authority. Just because you've got it doesn't mean you've got to learn how to use your authority wisely. Because it is less shame and guilt-inducing, or it assuages shame you already have, you can become obsessed with serving others first. And we're not, again, in a biblical sense, we're not against that. We're not against you putting other people first. We're against you doing it for the wrong mental attitude motivation that seeks to control or deal with shame in an inappropriate way. That's much different than putting other people first because you realize it's a biblical imperative, you love the Lord, and you want to do it. That's very different than what we're talking about over here. So again, one of the things, and this is why it's so hard to judge people. How would you know the difference between somebody that was being controlling to try to alleviate guilt or shame and somebody who's doing it because they really want to apply a doctrine? But there is a huge difference. But obviously for us, it's very difficult to judge that. How would you know? I mean, unless you could read their mind. And I haven't been blessed with that gift yet, thank God. Don't think I'd always want to know what all of you were thinking. So you can be obsessed with serving others first, unaware that guilt and shame are the motivators for such generous behavior. Some people are generous, not because they're generous, but because they're guilty. That's not appropriate biblically. That is what Jesus was talking about. If you don't give, as he says, for the right reasons, it's not going to be blessed. God's not going to honor it. So you have to stop and ask yourself hard questions. Now, am I really doing this for the right reason? I mean, you got to stop and examine sometimes. And be brutally honest with yourself and say, you know, really, I'm just doing this because I feel guilty. Then stop right there and don't go any further. Recognize it for what it is and then beat it. Just, I don't, I'm not doing it. And then walk off with a good feeling instead of more guilt. Oh, now I feel worse. And that's the person, you know, they beat guilt and then they turn around and feel guilty for beating guilt. Well, that's sick, but that's the way it is sometimes. Three, we're not advocating any doctrine that suggests that believers are not to serve one another. That's what Galatians 5:13 says, serving one another. Or that they should not be generous. We're not advocating that either. It says, for people to be generous. So 1 Timothy 6:18, it says, you know, tell those who are wealthy in this present world to be generous. To be rich in good works, generous, ready to share. We're for that. We just want you doing it for the right reasons. And that includes proper motivation. We are stating that guilt and shame are inappropriate motives, and we'll disqualify the application as divine good production. So that's what we're trying to get at here, is that this isn't divine good if you do it with the wrong motive. No matter how great the sacrifice, no matter how wonderful your ideas, if you're doing it with the wrong motive, it's not rewardable. So again, you have to think through this. I have to think through it. Okay, why am I doing what I'm doing? And you have to stop and evaluate yourself from time to time. For true Christian love should be the motivation behind all service, without which any overt application is hollow. 1 Corinthians 13, 1 through 3. And it doesn't matter how great your gifts, how magnificent your eloquence is, doesn't matter how much you know, the extent of your great, incredible knowledge. What does matter is if you don't do things out of love, it doesn't mean anything. That's what it really boils down to. If I speak with the tongues of men and angels, and Paul's engaging here in what we call a rhetorical device called hyperbole. And hyperbole is exaggerating everything to the nth degree, to make a point. You say, is it wrong to exaggerate to make a point? Well, they do it in the Bible. Paul does it. He's exaggerating to make a point. He couldn't speak with the tongues of angels. He's not an angel. What he's doing here is trying to exaggerate. But I do not have love, I have become a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. And if I have the gift of prophecy and know all mysteries and all knowledge. And see, that's part of the gift of prophecy. You have insight into things that other people don't. And so, but is it possible to know all mysteries and have all knowledge? No, not unless you're God. That's what I'm saying. He's taking this to an extreme. But if I all knowledge, and if I have all faith, so as to remove mountains, but do not have love, I am nothing. And if I give all my possessions to feed the poor, and if I deliver my body to be burned, but do not have love, it profits me nothing. And love has got to be the motivation. We're talking about Christian love here. While I understand this has been taught to refer to the filling of the Spirit, which you got to have, you can't separate the two at a certain level. You've got to be doing things for the right motivation. And the proper motivation is love, not guilt, and not shame. It's love. So, some people may exhibit a tendency to control others since they have experienced shame through a loss of control. And so they try to control everything. Okay, I experienced shame because things got out of control. I'm going to make sure things never get out of control again. You will drive yourself insane, and probably the rest of us too. You can't control the world, Arthur. That's just the way it is. You spoiled little shit. Well, that was, sometimes we just need to be told that. We need that little slap in the face from the butler that tells us, hey, wake up, wait a minute, So, people, again, you examine yourself. Why am I trying to control this? What is my motivation? F, some attempt to avoid shame by becoming excessively sensitive or hypercritical. One, this person can become obsessed with the words and deeds of others, especially when any implication of any wrongdoing is intimated or suggested. Two, this type of person can read harmful or hurtful intentions into the most benign of comments, engaging in mental attitude judging that imputes the worst to others. Sometimes, you know what, I know this is going to kill y'all, but I want every one of you to listen to me, and I mean it for every one of you. It's not always all about you. The world doesn't revolve around you. The earth revolves around the sun. But the world doesn't revolve around you. And every time everybody says something, it isn't aimed at you. And you see people and they take the most benign comments sometimes, and they'll make a big deal out of them in their mind, and you'll think, that person didn't even mean that. How did you take that so seriously, so personally, when they were just making a general comment? And we've all probably done it. I'll be up here teaching, and, I've had people tell me this after. I knew you were talking about me. You looked right at me. I want to be telling you, as I've told you before, when I've got my glasses off, you're all just a blur. Every one of you, just a blur, a little positive blur sitting there. And I may look at you, I may appear to be looking at you. I may be appearing to stare right through you. Sometimes it's just a little bit of a guilty conscience now, isn't it? Oh, you're staring at me. No, I wasn't. And it's never been my style. If I think you're really guilty of something, it's never been my style just to stare at you and let you know that you're guilty. You ever see me do that? No. But, the point is that people take it personally, and sometimes it's not all about you. I've got a lot of people to teach, and you aren't the only one. Doesn't mean I don't love you. I love you. But doesn't mean you're the only one. So people will make some comment on break. Somebody's out of fellowship for the next 6 months. We're on break. Don't take it too seriously. It's not the end of the world. And even if they meant something mean and nasty to you, I'll tell you how to solve it. Rather than stewing in your juices, pick up the phone after class. You said thus and such a break. Were you talking about me? And then they'll say, didn't you listen in second session? It's not all about you. No, I wasn't talking about you. Or they might say, yeah, I think you're... But then you can deal with it. And that's how believers ought to deal with one another. Honestly, straightforward. It's not all about you. Three, they are certain that others are constantly judging them and unfortunately believe that another's judgments are the chief concern. Don't worry about if people are judging. Look, if I'm judging you today, what are you going to do about it? What can you do about it? Nothing. The problem's mine. if I'm judging you. And if people want to sit around and judge you, go to town, baby. I'll give you lots of stuff. You can judge me about all kinds of things. Go to town. Judge to your little heart's content. Oh, but just plan on coming under judgment, a lot of it. Because the same measure you judge me by is the measure God's going to judge you by. And, you know, so the point is you can't worry about if people are judging you. If they're judging you, they're judging you. What are you going to do? I want people never to judge me anymore. Okay, I'll get right on that, the Lord says. No, it's going to happen. Believers have to learn to police themselves. You got to not judge other believers. Don't impute motive where you don't know. And that's what judging is. It's the wrong imputation of motive. For they fall into the trap of always trying to save face, wrongly believing that how others perceive them is as important as how God perceives them, or how they perceive themselves. Five, on the other hand, the critical person engages in trying to avoid shame by giving it away. They fall into the trap of believing they are better than others and seek to avoid any feeling of shame by acting or feeling superior. And so they walk around, I can't do it, but they do the superior dance all the time. And they're better, and they know it. And by God, you're just never going to quite measure up. Well, guess what? If people want to be that way, let them be that way. Don't let it drag you down. Don't become hypercritical. Other people make mistakes. Guess what? So do you. And guess what? God's going to have to deal with them, and God will grow them up. He's worked in your life to this point. He's worked in my life to this point. He hasn't written me off, and I've done some really stupid stuff. None of which I'll share here. But I've done some really stupid stuff. Guess what? God didn't write me off. He's still working with me. I'm still growing as far as I know. Still able to study. Still have questions. You know. So, again, don't let people get to you and don't engage in this stuff. Again, these are, again, faulty ways to try to handle shame or guilt. Gee, some people cave into the shame and become withdrawn and or paralyzed. One, people can become so overcome by the fear of doing, acting, or saying, or being wrong that they eventually collapse, give in, and choose inactivity, silence, and the status quo. Two, others withdraw from situations and run away. They choose to seek out private and secure places where they can withdraw into their loneliness. And this is a part of people that engage in excessive shame. Loneliness and depression quickly become a part of this. And this isn't the way I want to live my life. I don't know how you want to live your life. That isn't the way I want to live mine. I'll feel bad. I'll apologize. And boy, Lord knows, I've done some stunts where I've had to go around and apologize to people individually, one at a time, you know, 10, 15, 20 people. And I hated that, frankly. But you know what? It was healthy. It was what needed to be done. When you've sinned, go admit it. Confess it. Now, I could have run away and said, I'm just never going to acknowledge that. And I'm just going to pretend, you know, I just won't ever talk to any of them anymore. And that way, you know, well, that doesn't help. That doesn't work. That doesn't solve the problem. In fact, that just creates a greater problem. The last thing I understood about the word fellowship in the Greek, koinonia, it means to share stuff in common. That's what the word means, is common. And at a certain level, you have to share the good, the bad, and the ugly in a local church. And you get it all, trust me. But, you know, people tend to focus on the bad and the ugly. Let's face it. But, you know, there's a lot of good things that happen, too. There are people that have grown spiritually, made, you know, spiritual advance and made good applications and all of that. And you can focus on the bad and the ugly all you want, but it doesn't mean that that's all there is. And sometimes we have to choose to think about the good stuff. That's what Paul told the Philippians. Whatever things are good, whatever things are pure, whatever things are lovely, if there's any good report out there, think on these things. Don't think about all the junk going on. And this was in the context, by the way, of these two women, Odious and Soon Touchy, that were in a fight. And so, you know, you can focus on that. There's a big fight going on in our church. Odious and Soon Touchy are out there. That's not really their names, but, you know. Or you can focus on, you know, then somebody broke it up and they apologized and they moved on and they forgave and they forgot. And you can focus on that. So, again, it's all out there. And you running away from situations doesn't solve the problem. The problem's still going to be there. And wherever you run to, let me tell you what's going to be there waiting on you. Your STA is going to be there waiting on you. Wherever you get, you will be there, all right. But your STA will be with you. And if you're running for inappropriate reasons, God's going to be there with a little bit of discipline for you, too. So he'll be waiting with you with a, God's discipline and your STA. That sounds like a fun combination. Not hardly. So again, withdrawing or running away from things, sometimes we just have to make hard decisions not to withdraw, not to pull back. To just say, you know, I'm going to go ahead, I'm going to be myself, I'm going to be the same person I was. Yeah, I fouled up, okay. I'm aware of that. I know it. I'm just going to go on and be me. I'm going to trust in God's forgiveness, and I'm going to trust that believers can be grace-oriented enough to forgive and forget and move on. And you know what? I found out they can. They absolutely can. And so to sit around and hold grudges and all of that, or to withdraw from people based on whatever motivation, that's just not appropriate. Doesn't solve the problems. Three, the problem with attempting to run away or withdraw from your shame is that the STA is with you wherever you go. And running away never solves anything. And, I mean, all the great literature, you know, all the things that happened, the guy ran off and did this and that, and guess what? It didn't solve his problem. He ended up having to go back and confront it, generally speaking. And the book of Philemon, if you're not familiar, is about this runaway slave named Onesimus, who became a believer under Paul's ministry in Rome, and Paul's friend Philemon owned this guy, and so Paul sent him back and said, here's the will of God for you, it's to go back and submit to your master. And he sent the letter with Onesimus and told Philemon, I'm sending him back, and I would rather have him here helping me, he's been a great help and all of that, but I'm not going to do that without asking you, he's your property. And so Paul, and that's what the whole book of Philemon's about. So again, running away, he ends up back at home with his master. Doesn't solve the problem. Running away doesn't deal with guilt or shame or any other emotion, frankly. H, some react to shame by making bad decisions or by refusing to make decisions at all. One should evaluate his decisions in life and ask why he's choosing this action or path. Very often, it may relate to the point above. And it's always a bad decision to run away or isolate oneself. Two, others come to believe that it is so important to always be right in their decisions, they become unable to make a decision lest it be the wrong one. At a certain level, as a believer, you've got to learn to trust yourself. And that's not always easy. Because you look at yourself and you've seen what kind of idiotic things you've done in the past. And you think, how can I trust myself? Well, God's got you here, and if you're in fellowship, you've got to learn to trust yourself and move on. And you've got to have a fearlessness about that. I'm just going to trust myself and move on. Better or worse, this is it, God. Here I am. Take me or leave me. I'm going to trust myself and move on. And so I can't get so paralyzed with fear or guilt or shame or any other emotion to where I just stop functioning. I'm not going to apply anymore. Well, okay. Guess what? Doesn't solve the problem. Still doesn't get to the root of the problem. The problem's internal. Three, these types can easily succumb to the pressure of becoming a perfectionist who cannot allow failures, lest he add to his own shame. And guess what? If you're a perfectionist, you're going to drive yourself and everybody else crazy. We're not going to make perfection in this life. You have to accept what you get. You get what you get, and it's not always perfect. And you're not going to be perfect. You say, well, I really want to do it right. Well, good for you, so do I. But we're not going to be perfect at it. We're going to fail. We'll probably fail today. If we don't fail today, don't worry. It'll be by tomorrow or the next day. It won't take us long. But guess what? You fail, you pick up, you rebound, you move on. You trust in grace. And that requires a real reliance upon grace and not upon how good I am. It relies on the grace of God. I can rebound. God's going to forgive me. You bring that same sin to God that you've confessed 100 times before, and you know which one it is. And you confess it 101 times. And guess what? He forgives you the same 101st time, just like he did the first time. And people don't like that doctrine. They say, no, God can't keep doing that. If he doesn't, we're all in trouble, trust me. You're going to have that sin that does you in or trips your trigger or whatever you want to call it. And you're going to confess it over and over and over and over again. And every time you do, God does the same thing. So obviously, does he want us to think about it and have appropriate guilt and deal with it? Well, sure. But to say, well, then I can't confess it, well, that's taking a stupid tack, in my opinion. One, rage and anger are another method by which people deal with shame. One, very often the shame they feel is due to the actions of another. And one way to fight the humiliation is to attack the attacker. And so some people get angry, and then they let anger control them. And they think that's dealing with their shame. It's not dealing with your shame. It doesn't change that. But, two, rage and anger make the victim feel empowered, not realizing they are letting their shame control them. And that's one nice thing about being mad all the time, is that you're in control when you're mad. You don't listen to anybody else. You don't think about what they're saying. You're not taking any of that into consideration. You're in charge. You're running the show. And that's just sometimes a way of dealing with other issues. And so you have to think, well, you know, why, you know, I was watching TV the other night, actually, the tape, but I was watching Joey, and this kid that looks at his mom and says, why is your first response to everything anger? And she stopped for a second and says, I don't know. And I thought, well, it's genetic. It's your STA. And, of course, they can't deal with that on commercial television, but it was real obvious to me. It's like, you know, that's just her response because that's her STA. She, you know, what's she angry about? You know, some of it's just genetic. She's just born angry. Some people are born liars. So you got people with genetic predispositions to certain things. It doesn't mean those things have to run your life, though. And it doesn't mean that those sinful things are designed to deal with other issues, like shame, for instance. So again, it's you know, we might feel mad, but guess what? Rage and anger, you can't run your life over that. Let every man be quick to hear, slow to speak, and slow to anger. But anger makes us feel powerful when we're angry. And we vent our frustration and our rage or all of that, but guess what we're not feeling? We're not feeling any shame. I guarantee you that. Well, Jay, people can allow shame to make them irrational. One, because many irrational beliefs lie behind guilt and shame, people may be unable to sort out how they actually feel. That's a challenge, too. Sometimes you have to sit down and ask yourself, how do I actually feel right now? Get in touch with yourself. And a lot of people aren't even in touch with themselves, let alone in touch with God. If you're not in touch with yourself, why? Okay, now here's how I feel. How do I feel right now? I feel mad. Okay, now next question. Why do I feel mad? I feel mad because that idiot cut me off at the stoplight. All right. Now, next question. Can you control that idiot? Nope. So is your anger doing you any good? Nope. So what are you going to do about it? You can either sit there and stew in your juices and continue to be mad, or you can rebound it and deal with it and move on. Until the next stoplight, when the next idiot cuts you off, and then the same thing happens again and again and again and again. Then eventually you're going to have to come to grips with the fact that, hey, I can't control everybody. Sure can't control how people drive. So the first thing is ask yourself, how do I feel? What am I actually feeling here? Because sometimes we're, you know, we might express it. See, men are good at this. See, I express everything through anger. If I'm worried, you know how I express it? Anger. If something scares me, fear, I express it with anger. If, you know, I can't think of any other things, but there are probably other things, and I'll probably express it through anger. I didn't get my way, anger. You know, whatever it is. And you express things through your genetic, in this case, predisposition to these things. And but what's the real issue over here? You know, people just assume, well, he's mad. That isn't it. He's not mad. He's worried. There's a huge difference. He isn't dealing with his worry, and he's expressing it through anger. But, and see, that's irrational. We ought to express worry, you know, with something besides anger. And so you've got to ask yourself, how do I really feel? How do I really feel? Because sometimes we're so out of touch with how we actually feel about the situation. We're just reacting or going off or doing this or that. But we haven't stopped and thought about, how do I feel about it? We just emote in sometimes. Well, two, it is important to be objective with yourself when you are experiencing guilt and shame. Be sure your decisions are based on sound, rational thinking. Three, since your life ultimately becomes the decisions you make, it is critical to make sound doctrinal decisions as you go. And that's what you have to deal with on an ongoing, everyday, day-to-day basis is, look, what my life's going to be tomorrow and next week and next month and next year is a cumulative total of the decisions I'm making now. And so I better spend some time thinking about what I'm supposed to be doing and making sure I'm on the same wavelength with God as much as possible. So, again, you deal with these things, and in some ways, you probably have noticed through this section, there aren't hardly any verses to document this. But some of this stuff is such basic common sense that even the cosmos knows this. You can go to a lot of websites and find a lot of this same information. Because people have recognized this is the reality of the way people function. And I believe some of it is just good spiritual common sense, even sometimes good physical common sense, that people don't deal with things. Even a good psychologist could tell you people have different motivations and different fears and different things going on that cause them to act the way they act. And so we want to try, obviously, what's our goal? Our goal is to grow up and reflect the way Jesus Christ would act. What would Ron do? That's got to be your question. And if you can do that, you're well on the way to figuring out what Jesus would do. That wasn't funny. So, these are, again, principles that you have to think through, and it's good, I think, to stop and recognize. Because sometimes people on doctrine act like, if you have any emotion, it's entirely inappropriate. No. Emotions were given by God. Emotions themselves aren't inappropriate. It's the way we deal with them. It's the way we orient to them or relate to them. We can't let emotions control us. That's never been the intention. But like the responders of the soul, they're there to express what's going on around us. And emotions are healthy. They're not unhealthy. It's just figuring out how to deal with them and what emotions are appropriate when and where. And that's really kind of what we're studying here. All right, well, our time's up, so we will continue to... Actually, we'll wrap this up probably Wednesday and get back into the text. So have your notes for the rest of chapter 16 ready. Thank you, Father, for the privilege of studying your word. May God, the Holy Spirit, sanctify this information to our souls. In Christ's name, amen.